late, and but we're happy to be here, and we're happy you all are here. This morning we have with us the Warsaw East High School students. Would they rise, please? Thank you. Please be seated. This class is here with the Court with Class program that the Wisconsin Supreme Court has undertaken with the State Bar. This is an award-winning program, in fact, two national prizes. And we're delighted you're here. We hope that you will find this oral argument informative. The class has received a synopsis of these arguments and may have met with counsel, not these counsel, about this presentation. They will also be here at noon, and we'll meet with Justice Crooks, who will discuss the court procedures with you. You will be joining colleagues of yours from Warsaw East High School, too. Now that you have been introduced to us, I would like to introduce the court to you. On my far left is Justice David Prosser. To his right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To my immediate left is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Donald Steinmetz, and to his right, Justice John Wilcox, and on the far right, Justice Patrick Crooks. With the introductions made, we will call the first case, 97-2594, State Farm Mutual Insurance Company versus Ford Motor Company. Representing State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company is Patrick Coffin. Mr. Coffin.
May it please the court, my name is Patrick Coffey. I practice law in Appleton, Wisconsin at the Menn Law Firm. I represent State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company, the plaintiff appellant in this matter. This case came before this court based on a certification from the Court of Appeals out of Warsaw. The issue essentially is, does the economic loss doctrine apply to consumer transactions to bar recovery and tort for damage to an item only? The item we're talking about is damage to a 1990 Ford Bronco 4x4. I think that the facts have been adequately outlined in the briefs. So what I'd like to do is to get right to the issue, which is whether or not this doctrine should apply to consumer transactions. The way that I've always viewed the economic loss doctrine through the pendency of this case is that it's a court-made doctrine where the courts have essentially said to the plaintiffs in manufacturing cases, commercial cases, Mr. Plaintiff, you had an opportunity to negotiate. You had an opportunity to allocate risk. You had an opportunity to bargain. You did that with the defendant, and now down the road something has gone wrong, and you want to come back and go through tort to get your remedy. But we're not going to let you do that because you had those opportunities to effectively negotiate this contract. The difference in this case is that State Farm now stands in the shoes of Mr. Renberg. According to the American Standard case outlined in my brief, that I think is how the court should analyze the situation, is through Mr. Renberg's point of view. And when Mr. Renberg purchased this vehicle, he did not have an opportunity to effectively negotiate with Ford Motor Company. Ford Motor Company specifically withdrew from this contract. They offered an extended service plan, but it was a form contract. There was no opportunity to talk about the real specific term in that contract, which Ford says we're not going to cover recall items. If Mr. Renberg had wanted to negotiate on that term, he wouldn't have had an opportunity to do that. And for those reasons, we believe that the economic loss doctrine should not apply in consumer transactions where there has not been an opportunity to effectively negotiate, effectively allocate risk, effectively bargain for things.
Practically, how would that work? He had an extended warranty. He bought that. He also had his own insurance here. Obviously, that's State Farm. That's why they're here. Now, how would you handle that on the practical basis of having each consumer bargain or saying, well, now we're going to have the economic loss doctrine and therefore we're going to include consumer as we have already included commercial? When I look at the Dannon case, that's the one versus Cedar Rapids, there are three what I call reasons in there. How would that fit those three reasons then?
The Dannon and Jansen case and the three policies are, number one, that we have to preserve the difference between contract and tort. Number two, that it is the buyer that is better able to understand the extent of his damages and therefore is better able to insure against those damages. And number three, that the court wanted to protect commercial parties' freedom to allocate risk. Taking the first issue, which I think is an important issue, the way that I view this case is in consumer transactions. Those three policies in the Dannon and Jansen court, the court said that those were three policies for commercial transactions. In consumer transactions, the court goes into the difference between contract and tort. Contract outlines duties based on an agreement between the parties, and society is going to uphold that agreement because we want some certainty in those types of agreements.
Don't the facts here take it out of that category? There was no direct relationship or bargaining or any type of contact between the man and the Ford Motor Company. It was with a dealer, wasn't it?
That's correct.
Are you saying that the dealer is a substitute for Ford Motor Company?
No, I'm not. What I'm saying is because there was no contract between them, yeah, it's difficult to impose a contract theory, which is the economic loss doctrine, on Mr. Renberg.
Except he was offered an extended contract, and he bought it.
Yes, he was offered an extended service plan that he wasn't allowed to negotiate for or to allocate risk. This was a form contract. And this court, in the Wisconsin telephone case, said that that's an important element, that you need to, I believe it was this court, it might have been the Court of Appeals, but it was a Wisconsin telephone case where the court said you need to be able to have an opportunity to go someplace else. And the Gurna case out of California says all of these form contracts are the same, whether it's Ford, Chrysler, General Motors, or Toyota. So he had no opportunity to contract. He really had no ability to go elsewhere for this form contract, the extended service plan.
Mr. Coffey, is it correct that the majority of states that have the economic loss doctrine, when asked to adopt the consumer exception that you're asking us to adopt, have said no and have rejected that?
I haven't counted the cases actually in all the jurisdictions to know for sure if there's a majority, but from the cases I run across, I found more that would agree with Ford. So I would be inclined to say the majority of jurisdictions do agree with Ford rather than State Farm.
And is that because of the practicalities involved, trying to draw the line between who is a consumer and whether it's a consumer transaction or a commercial transaction?
That I don't know, because there are cases like the state of Minnesota, which on one hand has the case State Farm versus Ford Motor Company, which says we've got to apply this statute. In Minnesota, they have a statute that codifies the economic loss doctrine that says we have to apply this statute, and therefore we're not going to have a consumer exception. But it has other cases like the Hopka decision, where it does apply to a consumer transaction. So it's difficult for me to answer your questions because these courts are kind of all over the place, even within a single jurisdiction. Some courts are clear. I think Pennsylvania, for example, is clear. We're not going to find a consumer transaction. I think one of the justifications is it's too difficult to do that on a case-by-case basis.
Let me ask you this. Did you have the opportunity to review the briefs at all in the companion case, the General Casualty versus Ford case?
I had an opportunity. I have to say that I didn't review them that thoroughly, though.
Well, let me, and I don't want to be unfair to you because that's not your case, but my understanding in that case is that plaintiffs have urged a different type of exception, that they've talked about a sudden and calamitous event and using that as the basis to create an exception. What do you think about that?
I looked at the sudden and calamitous event, and first of all, I think that even presents even more practical problems for application throughout the state, number one. Number two, I had difficulty putting this case into a sudden and calamitous event exception because my client, Mr. Renberg, was in his place of work at the time. this fire started and actually extinguished itself while no one was around. And number three, I don't recall the case offhand, but I do believe that there is a case which questions that sudden calamitous event exception. And I thought that when reading that case, and I apologize for not knowing it, but when reading that case, I thought that analysis was appropriate, that that is an exception would be too difficult to apply versus the consumer exception, which I don't think would be difficult to apply.
Well, now, what about if a car starts on fire spontaneously? Sounds a little sudden to me. Even if it smolders for several hours, it's a sudden event, and it's somewhat calamitous, I suppose, for that car and the person who owns it. So it seems to me that although we might disagree about what's sudden and what's calamitous, I mean, obviously there are going to be extremes on both sides, and in the middle it gets a little hazy. That might be a lot easier than who's a consumer. A corporation, small family corporation in Madison, looks commercial, but when you have it up against a transnational giant, it looks a little like a consumer. And Abrahamson against a local business may look like a consumer, and they may look like commercial. So it's very hazy to me what you mean by consumer. In fact, it seems to me that that's the toughest part of your case.
I would agree that there's no clear definition, and I don't think this court should adopt an absolute definition. If you make above $50,000, you are all of a sudden deemed to be sophisticated enough, or if you are incorporated in the Secretary of State's office, you are all of a sudden deemed to be a commercial party. But I think that the courts in throughout their cases have outlined various elements to look at. Again, I get back to constantly referring to the allocation of the risk, bargain for agreements, sophistication of the parties. Another element I think that needs to be looked at is under Chapter 421, which deals with consumer transaction. That defines consumer, what a consumer is, and it defines it as a customer.
What about equality of bargaining power?
Equality of bargaining power is most definitely another element that needs to be looked at.
How do we? That seems like a very slippery slope, though. In line with the Chief's question, where's the line drawn?
Well, I think the line is drawn after looking at all of the factors. I don't think that I can stand here and draw a line and say, if you have 100 employees, you all of a sudden have enough bargaining power to be a commercial transaction. I don't think that a line should be drawn in those cases, or in any case. But when the court has repeatedly referred to equality of bargaining power as an element to look at when defining whether or not the economic loss doctrine should be used, it's an element I think that the trial court should review. Other elements to look at are whether or not it's an as-is sale. This was an as-is sale. That certainly is a factor that goes against my position, but it's an element that I think that the court should look at. And I don't deny that it's difficult to define that, but I think it's easier to define that based on the policies between tort and contract than it is to define a sudden and calamitous event.
Now, let me just ask you, because this, if we're going to do this on a quote case-by-case basis, and you talk about the sophistication, certainly someone that's, let's take this example of the case we have, you have someone who is sophisticated, knows cars, is a mechanic, et cetera, versus someone that couldn't tell the steering wheel from the brake pedal, for example. Now, that is a difference in sophistication. Wouldn't it be very difficult to, if you're going to have all of these factors, and then say, well, we have to look at all of these, and that's why we need to have this apply, the economic loss doctrine, apply to consumer transaction? I have some difficulty where you can compare monetary amounts, you can compare intellectual abilities and the mechanical abilities. That's one of the problems you run into when you open this up. Isn't that a concern that you have? How would you address that if we were to say, let's do it?
Okay. And the way that I would address it is to outline those issues that the court should look at, and the concern that you have is essentially the slippery slope argument that, right, that Justice Babbage brought up. The slippery slope argument, in my opinion, is an argument that It's kind of that term that courts get very nervous about, and I don't really think that, practically speaking, we have a problem here. The reason is we can look at a lot of these definitions in other cases. Chapter 421 outlines what a consumer transaction is. The UCC outlines what a merchant is, and it makes a distinction there between merchants and non-merchants. These other policies, that a companion issue that I think you're concerned about is, don't we open up the floodgates of litigation? That's another one of those terms that courts get real nervous about, a slippery slope that's going to open up the floodgates of litigation. And I think if you look at it, practically speaking, these are product liability cases. Product liability cases cost thousands and thousands of dollars to prosecute and to defend against. Ford Motor Company certainly has spent a lot of money on this case. Practically speaking, there's a self-weeding process. Not all consumers are going to go after the manufacturer. Not all manufacturers, if the law is outlined in this state, are going to say, we don't have to pay because of the economic loss doctrine.
I want to understand exactly what your argument is, and it's a little blurred, not your argument, my perception of it is. You started out by saying we should not apply the economic loss doctrine in consumer transactions where they don't have an opportunity for equal bargaining power. But my sense is you're not saying that. My sense is you're saying we should not apply the economic loss doctrine in consumer transactions, period. Because once you say where they don't have an opportunity for equal bargaining power, then you have this Pandora's box. That I say this because now you are developing an argument of, look, for years we've had the UCC to determine what's a merchant, what isn't a merchant. We've had Chapter 421 to determine what is a consumer. So we have some definitions that are workable, that are perhaps finite. At least we've governed our commercial transactions by those definitions for years, and the state hasn't fallen apart. But my concern is, once you start getting into the where they're to use it as a measure for it being applied where there is equal opportunity for bargaining power, rather than a justification for its application, you have problems. Heretofore, our cases have all said in commercial transactions, and the equality of bargaining power is a justification for applying it in commercial transactions. So that's a kind of a summary for you arguing what you're saying. I want to know, are you just saying don't apply the economic loss doctrine in consumer transactions, period, or in consumer transactions where they do not have equality and bargaining power? What's your position?
I think that both of those arguments are very similar. I can think of examples where a consumer transaction would have equal bargaining power. My argument is that the court has never applied it in consumer transactions, period. They haven't done it because there has not been equal bargaining power. There has not been an allocation of the risk. And I think that and that's the rule that I'm advocating. And if that rule is laid down by this court, it becomes relatively easy in looking at other areas of law to say, this is commercial or this is consumer. And then the reason for not applying it in a consumer transaction is those other reasons that I've talked about. What I think this essentially boils down to is outlined fairly well in the Ice Bowl decision, which I updated the court on either late last week or early this week. The Ice Bowl decision is from Judge Reynolds in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. It involved a case where Ice Bowl was going to provide a sports celebrity, and Weagle Broadcasting was going to provide airtime and money, and on a Milwaukee television station. And something had happened, tort causes of action were brought, and the court ultimately held, hey, you're a commercial party here, Ice Bowl, you should have contracted for this. But the court went on to look at some of the elements, and it even implied that one of the elements is that Ice Bowl wasn't claiming it was a consumer in this situation. It said in the decision, Ice Bowl is not claiming it's a consumer. It listed out a couple of other things that Ice Bowl was not claiming, and it said it looks as though all of the elements of the economic loss doctrine are here. And so Justice Reynolds, or Judge Reynolds, indicated that that may even be an actual element that's already been defined by this court and by the courts of appeals. Judge Reynolds went on to compare it to real estate and the Allenman decision and how we hold commercial sellers of real estate to a higher duty of disclosure because we don't want them, I believe the word he used was to be at the mercy. We don't want regular old consumers to be at the mercy of sophisticated commercial sellers.
Well, let's just look at this case in terms of what you just said. You want consumers at the mercy of sophisticated sellers. Now, Mr. Renberg, right, purchased a used Ford vehicle as is from Nina Menasha Ford.
Yes.
It's an everyday occurrence in this state.
Yes.
Mr. Renberg is on notice that Nina Menasha Ford says, hey, this is your car, as is, no guarantees, might burn up tomorrow, right? And to protect himself, Renberg purchased for $895, that's a lot of money, extended service warranty contract from Ford. So now they're in a contractual relationship, right?
Yes.
Okay. And the warranty contract expired. I assume maybe they could have gotten another warranty contract. They decided not to. Maybe Ford doesn't give warranties after a certain age. I don't know. But they don't happen. Nina Menasha agreed as is. Renberg bought it that way. Okay. This Ford now burns up, right? And Ford issued a recall notice and with respect to the very defect that apparently caused this fire, right? So who in this transaction isn't on appropriate notice? Who has been invaded or who has had an unfair deal or an unfair negotiation here? It seems to me everybody was dealing at arm's length. Everybody knew what everything was about.
I think that a couple of facts are important for the court to note. Number one, on the extended service plan, that was an application. He had to buy this car, whether or not the application was accepted.
Sure.
The second element is the extended service plan specifically excludes recall items.
Okay.
And the third element is I think if we had backed up this fire another 2 months, and he had gotten his recall before the fire occurred, Ford Motor Company, despite what their extended service plan says, would have had to have fixed it. What we're dealing with here is a situation, just the timing worked out where the fire occurred first, and now Ford Motor Company says, we don't want to fix it because it's going to cost us too much. In my opinion, the person who's getting hurt in that, the person who doesn't have or has the expectation to get recall items fixed and can't get them fixed, is Mr. Renberg. I think that if at the time of contracting you asked Mr. Renberg, you have this plan here and it says we don't cover recall items, but if we send out a recall, do you think your car is going to get fixed? He would say, yes, I do, because that's the way recalls work in this country. But because of the timing of it, the fire happened first and then the recall came out, Ford Motor Company takes the position, we don't have to fix it because we have the economic loss.
Suppose it had burned up after the recall, before he can get in, he gets the notice in the mail at noon and he says, going to go to take this car right to Ford and get it repaired. And as he leaves the store, boom, car blows up.
In my opinion, I would still say that Mr. Renberg has an expectation to get that vehicle fixed. And if he does everything to mitigate his damages, if he truly is going to get the vehicle fixed when, boom, it burns up, then he should still get it fixed by Ford Motor Company.
What are the rules about recall? I mean, are there rules that the company had under the federal rules about recalling and defects in cars, is it required that Ford fix it?
Under the National Highway Safety Act, the difficulty with this case is summary judgment was filed very early. I don't know if this was a voluntary recall or if it was imposed by the Department of Transportation, and I don't know what the rules are in terms of what the Department of Transportation says if a vehicle comes in after the defect has blown up or has started on fire, you've got to fix it anyway. I don't know what the answer to that question is.
So that may be a different case than the one you're presenting.
It may be.
If you have, what is the public policy behind it? Let's say there's no limitation. Let's say this happened 20 years from the time the vehicle was sold, and you would still, and this is probably going back to the slippery slope, but there would be no end to this from a public policy standpoint. Then all of society would basically bear the cost of this type of, quote, recovery, in the sense that this could be 60 years beyond that. You could have a defect or find out that this was a defective part without any time limits whatsoever. Do you think that that's a good policy?
Well, what I'm advocating is the economic loss doctrine is applied in commercial transactions because the court has said of the policies of contract. I'm saying that it shouldn't apply in consumer transactions because we look at the policies underlying tort and protect the little guy in society. Now, I'm not saying...
Well, we had an argument, little guy, or, you know, how are we defining small?
That is another issue. But to address your first issue, which was do we go for 20 years or 30 years, the economic loss doctrine simply allows Ford Motor Company or Mr. Rimberg or others in his position to get into court, and they still have to prove their case. The policy, the public policy that is served is laws of strict liability, laws of negligence still take effect. And as this court is well aware, the trial court still has six public policy reasons to cut this case out if it feels like the negligence is far outweighed by the damages or those other six public policy reasons. So I'm not asking the court to say I automatically win this case. I'm asking the court to say you can go under tort, and the public policy of tort is the one that takes over and then limits these 20, 30 years down the road with substantial changes in the product, with contributory negligence. So in a negligence case, the contributory negligence is a defense. So all of those defenses still help the defendant, and I think that's how public policy is served.
Thank you, Mr. Coffey. You will have 5 minutes for a rebuttal. Mr. Johnson, you represent Ford Motor Company.
May it please the court. My name is Terry Johnson, and I appear for the defendant respondent, Ford Motor Company.
Now, Mr. Johnson, before you begin, you weren't on any of these briefs for Ford, is that
no,
right?
No, I have appeared since the briefing was filed for purposes of the argument. And only with regard to this case, I haven't appeared in the companion case that's being decided on the briefs. Okay. And so if you ask me questions about that, I will be even more hard-pressed to answer them than counsel was a few moments ago, but I'll do my best.
That's what I thought. And you don't know whether the other firm is still representing Ford?
They are still representing as well. I'm just appearing as counsel for the argument.
Thank you.
Your Honor, this case is about one simple issue, and that is, should you carve out an exception from a very well-reasoned doctrine to help out State Farm? We could not have found a better case to demonstrate why they're wrong and we're right, because everything that the court has talked about in the commercial cases applies clearly here. There are reasons to protect the differences between tort law and contract law in this case. If you decide that the economic loss doctrine doesn't apply to these kinds of claims, if I were in a position to advise Ford, I am not, but if I were in a position to advise Ford, I would tell them there is no earthly reason to have warranties or to restrict warranties in any way other than for public relations, because you've just rendered them meaningless. Anyone, anytime, whoever has a problem with their vehicle can come in and sue you in tort, and you cannot limit your remedies. The reasons we have differences between contract law and tort law are because this court has recognized that in many situations it is better to permit the parties to decide upon their own rights and remedies in the form of a contract. That is no different in the consumer transaction than in the commercial. And it's no different for Mr. Renberg, because Mr. Renberg is obviously quite a bright fellow, and he made some very intelligent, reasonable decisions all the way along the line. First of all, he decided whether he wanted to buy a new car or a used car. Now, he didn't have to buy a used car.
If you'd stand in front of the microphone,
sure.
Please, thank you.
I tend to wander.
And I'll keep going like that. That's a signal.
I think once will remind me enough. Thank you. He didn't have to buy a used car. He could have bought a new car. And all of us know as consumers, there are significantly different warranty and contract rights he would have gotten by buying a new car. He didn't have to buy a car from Ford or a Ford dealer. He could have gone to any one of a number of other manufacturers. He could have gone to any one of the automotive used car superstores that have sprung up around the country. I passed several coming back from Appleton just the other day, and they all offered different warranties, and there's nothing in this record to suggest otherwise. He then had the right, once he bought his car, to decide whether he wanted to buy a warranty. He decided to buy it. He could have decided not to buy it. No one forced him to buy from Ford. No one forced him to buy the warranty. He made that decision. And then he made the final decision, which this court has specifically held in the past, is one reason why the economic loss doctrine exists. He decided to buy insurance. He decided in his mind he was going to invest some more money and change the allocation of the risk from Ford and him in an agreed-upon contractual way, in a significant way, to State Farm. State Farm charged him money, agreed to take on that risk, and now that they've had to pay on that risk, they come here and say, no, you should find a way so that we don't have to pay on the risk we charge the premium for.
Well, let me just ask you this. Ford puts out a whole line of cars.
Correct.
And advertises them as being quality cars. And now somebody buys it at a used car lot. And anything that has happened between your manufacturer and the purchase, I mean, Ford should not be liable for, right? I mean,
correct.
If I drive it carelessly and rip out the transmission or whatever, and then somebody buys it, Ford shouldn't be liable.
Correct. And in this case, we don't know what happened to that Bronco.
But if Ford puts out a product and it has an inherent defect, that is, a manufacturing defect, a serious one, let's just assume it. I mean, Ford probably doesn't do it, but let's just assume it. Okay?
Hypothetically.
So you have a manufactured defect that may not show up for a few years. And it won't show up even in all the cars that have the defect. You know, they'll pass. They're not going to blow up or whatever. Okay, now you've got this defect in 12, 15 years, let's say a long time for a car. This defect, which is caused initially by Ford, causes this car to burn up spontaneously. Now, there's no warranty, so you don't have privity and you don't have contract, we agree, and you bought it not from a Ford dealer, but from, as is, from a used car lot. Why shouldn't Ford, if negligence could be proved, let's just keep it simple and take away strict liability, if it's negligently manufactured, why shouldn't Ford be liable to whomever is damaged by that negligence? The concept in this state is foreseeability, and that you owe a duty of care to everybody, and that if somebody is injured or property is injured, you are liable. So why shouldn't Ford be liable for this defective car? And we're not asking for anything other than you pay for the value of the car at that time. What's the matter with that?
Well, first of all, I might raise the question of whether if you drove it happily for 12 or 15 years, in my experience with cars, whether you haven't gotten your value. But
let's take it 6 years. I mean, I'm just trying
to... The answer to the question is the court's already answered that question. In the commercial cases where the economic loss doctrine has been applied, the court has said there are ample public policy reasons for saying the party should decide this by contract. So the question here is not whether that result that you have described is appropriate or inappropriate. It is, should we make a difference in that result if Mr. Renberg bought the car personally, or if he owns Renberg Plumbing as a sole proprietorship and he has a Renberg logo that goes up in flames 6 or 12 years later? That's the issue. The court's already decided that there is a reason to make a difference in that.
I'm not persuaded, though. You know, you have to always look at things afresh, with precedent and with looking at prior cases. But, you know, you have to look at it fresh. New fact situations come up, and it gives you pause about what you said before.
If you're asking me what the rationale for the economic loss doctrine is, I will quote what this court has said, because it makes very good sense. There are reasons to permit parties to allocate rights and responsibilities between themselves within the limited scope of what could happen to this product: repairs, damage, loss of the product. Not in general, but there are reasons why the law has always permitted parties to do that, and we should place some value on preserving that. Number two, as the court said in its prior decisions, because of that first factor, society has a reason to want to protect the right of the parties to enter into contracts freely and make that allocation of risk. And third, the court has said that parties do have the ability in the mythical equal bargaining power situation, because of course you all know, he knows and I know, there's no such thing. Ford is not equal to everyone. State Farm is not equal to everyone. There are people that have them at a disadvantage. My law firm negotiates with insurance companies over rates. We don't have necessarily equal bargaining power with them. So the myth of equal bargaining power is not the answer. What the court has said is, do the parties have alternatives by which they can decide how to allocate risk, including insurance? As the court said in the Dana and Jansen case, commercial parties presumably have equal bargaining power, but went on to say, in what I think is the real definition of equal bargaining power, are generally free to set terms of their own agreement, including warranties, disclaimers, and limitation of remedies. Every consumer dealing with an automobile insurance company has that right. They have choices among warranties. They have choices between new and used cars. They have choices among dealers. They have choices among automobile companies.
Counsel, if you talk about cars, that's an easy fact situation because you have Ford and Chrysler and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. How about windmills?
Windmills?
Yeah, let's say there's only one manufacturer of windmills in the United States. So what kind of opportunity does a person who lives in Hillsboro, Wisconsin, who wants to put a windmill up, have in terms of shopping around? And because obviously the economic loss doctrine and the law that we're going to apply today isn't just for cars and the plentiful products, but there are products that are isolated, that are unique. What kind of protection then does a consumer have if the economic loss doctrine is applied there?
With all due respect, I suggest that the example, the hypothetical, is unrealistic. I do not know how many manufacturers of windmills there are. I know there's more than one.
Well, in my hypothetical, there is one.
And I guess the answer to that, Madam Justice, is that the court doesn't make law here for isolated individual situations. The court makes rules that make sense in the main. And if you looked at every rule you've ever enunciated here, I guarantee you I can find one example where someone perhaps is not getting the result one or more members of this court would have asked for. But that's not the job of this court. That's why you don't review every error in trial court.
Let's take the facts of this case then, and we won't go to windmills. Let's stay closer to the facts of this case and just turn one fact, and that is Mr. Renberg buys a used auto, but gets the warranty from the dealership. 6-month warranty, and that's it. You know, pays for it. It's part of the actual negotiation transaction. Ford Motor Company, at least allegedly, produced a defective product, a product that is the subject of a recall. The recall was, hey, there's going to be a fire that's going to start. This is a dangerous product. The fire occurs one day after the warranty with the dealer expires. What recourse does the consumer have for this admittedly defective product now?
He collects on his insurance policy. That's why he bought the insurance, because he, as a reasonable, rational human being, knows that he can't foresee every eventuality that might cause him to have damage to or loss to his automobile that he paid $11,000 for, and therefore he goes to people who are in the business of accepting money for taking that risk on themselves and then paying out.
And if he's a 20-year-old kid who says, hey, I'm not going to buy that kind of insurance, just the kind of insurance when we're going to get in an auto accident. I mean, my concern is this. You talk about insurance as one of your alternatives. Not everyone buys insurance. That's not part of everyone's reality, to buy extended warranties on televisions. Not part of everyone's economic opportunity.
Then those people.
So their alternative isn't realistic to them.
Then those people buy those products more cheaply. When I go to Best Buy to buy a refrigerator or American TV, perhaps I should say here in Madison, to buy a TV or a refrigerator, when I go out, they ask me, are you interested in buying a warranty? 1 year, 3 year, 5 years? And they want to sell those to me. If I choose not to buy that warranty, I've made a choice. It may turn out to be a good one, it may turn out to be a bad one, but if I don't buy the warranty, if I'm that 20-year-old, your hypothetical, who chooses not to buy it or chooses not to buy insurance, I've got more money in my pocket for having made that choice.
So State Farm, in my hypothetical, should be paying for the admittedly defective product of Ford Motor Company.
No. State Farm should incur the expense of the risk they were paid to incur. Namely, that car might be damaged for many, many reasons. A hailstorm. A fire that is caused by nothing in a defect with the car. There are many reasons why State Farm could pay. That's why they have very sophisticated, intelligent people who assess those risks and choose a premium that will enable them to make money despite taking it.
What about people who cannot afford to allocate the risk, Mr. Johnson?
If you want
this 20-year-old in Justice Bradley's example, or 50-year-old needs a car, exhausts their money. They simply can't afford $895 to allocate the risk. And there's no one else to allocate the risk to.
And can't afford insurance either?
No.
In all honesty, Your Honor, the practical, honest answer to that is someone in the stringent financial circumstances that you have described is going to buy a car that would not be worth pursuing a tort claim when the car burns up later.
One of my concerns, if I may.
I didn't understand his answer.
If you're positing someone who can't afford a warranty and can't afford insurance, that person's car, he also
Absolutely.
Can't afford a car. Sorry, he can't. I was wrong. He also can't afford a car that will be worth enough money to pursue what he has described as being a complicated, difficult product liability claim against Ford when that car burns up later. I mean, again, with all due respect, you are describing an example for which this lawsuit, this rule, will provide no remedy. He will have a $2,000 car, a $1,500 car. Is he going to hire a lawyer, pursue a tort claim to recover his damages for his $1,500 car?
No, he's going to write Ford and say, "Dear Ford, you had a recall notice, and my car burned up. Please send check to the above address." And Ford, I think, will send it.
You were admittedly negligent in manufacturing that car.
Oh, no one has admitted negligence in this case. I don't know that anyone
was
negligent.
Okay, so you're going to go into small claims court. Now, we'll see you all over the country in small claims court without a lawyer.
And I guess the other answer to that question is, if he's a businessman and he buys that same car for his little home repair company or whatever it is, then are we going to say he doesn't recover?
Well,
what's the difference?
What I'm getting at here, and I think you see where I'm going, is that the reality of the consumer world, anyway, is that an awful lot of people cannot afford to allocate risk. They can't afford to buy insurance. They can't. They may be able to afford to buy a refrigerator at Circuit City, but they can't afford the maintenance contract, whatever. That's just a reality of life. Now, it seems somewhat inherently unfair, and maybe the answer is life is unfair. But it seems inherently unfair that if the manufacturer of that refrigerator was negligent in the manufacturing of that refrigerator, which caused the refrigerator to blow up, then the person who bought that refrigerator should be able to recover from the manufacturer of the refrigerator.
And I guess the answer is, again, this court has already decided that the economic loss doctrine says that if that person is a business, under exactly the same straitened circumstances, perhaps even in bankruptcy when it
happens. That's sort of like when my dad always used to tell me that the reason we do something is because that's the way we've always done it. But I agree with the Chief Justice's answer, saying, well, let's get back, let's re-examine maybe some of those fundamental notions.
And what I'm suggesting is there were very good reasons, which they haven't questioned one bit, for why the economic loss doctrine has been applied to commercial businesses. And every example you gave in questioning counsel about the definitional problem and the fairness of it applies perfectly well to consumers. And therefore, there is no reason to treat the consumer differently simply because it is possible to imagine some rather unusual hypothetical circumstances in which someone who bought a refrigerator might be left without a remedy.
What difference, counsel, does it make then if there is the as-is clause? I mean, as this vehicle, as-is, that is an assumption that the consumer is taking a risk by buying that vehicle anyway,
right?
Without affording the warranty, the insurance, the selection, because some vehicles are sold as-is and some are sold that there is a warranty, or the dealer will have a long list of that he checked this, this, and this. Does as-is limit this risk?
Well, the as-is certainly puts that consumer on notice of the fact that no one is representing the quality of that car for any reason, and that he has some options, among them purchasing the extended warranty, among them purchasing insurance, among them having someone, before he buys the car, check out the mechanical condition of the car. I mean, there are many things that can be done to evaluate and try to deal with that risk, most of which Mr. Regner, in this case, appears to have taken advantage of.
If the court were to clearly apply the economic loss doctrine to consumer situations, would you think it appropriate to recognize any exceptions to the doctrine in those consumer situations?
I think the problem with it, with recognizing exceptions, which I think was exemplified by the questions that were asked during counsel's argument and the answers that were given, is that what you have in effect, it guaranteed, is a mini trial of such complexity and dimension that the practical effect will be to eliminate the application of the rule. If you are going to say that what the court has to do is engage in an elaborate fact-finding procedure on the sophistication of the consumer, or the alternatives that were open to the consumer, or what kind of bargaining power they had, or what process they had, I think as a practical matter what you have said is everyone will settle these cases and you have eliminated the economic loss doctrine, because the dollars involved in the individual transactions are relatively small. I mean, this is a used car in which there's an $11,000 claim. My belief is that's, as used cars go, that's a fairly expensive used car. If we had a $2,000 car here, and your rule said the court had to have a procedure to determine any individual set of facts to determine whether it applied, how could anyone litigate those cases? You might as well not adopt the exception. You might as well adopt the exception they want and make it blanket. But there's no rational basis for differentiating between consumers and commercial entities within the kinds of rules this court has already adopted.
Mr. Johnson, let me ask you a couple of questions about our precedent. You had referred earlier to the Danen and Jansen decision, which is the most recent decision from this court on economic loss. The Sunny Slope case, as you know, was an earlier decision on economic loss by this court. Those cases talk about the commercial purchaser and talk indeed about equal bargaining power. Are we going to have to reverse those cases or disown that language in order to follow your position?
I think that presents two different questions. Let me address both of them. There's nothing about those cases that would have to be changed in order to decide whether or not the rule that heretofore has been applied to commercial transactions should be applied to consumer transactions. Those cases didn't present that question. This court has not decided it. It's simply an additional issue which will be, I understand, decided in this case. In terms of whether the court has to abandon language from prior cases, I don't think it needs to, because as I read the language of the Danen and Jansen case, it doesn't just talk about equal bargaining power. It talks about free to set terms of the agreement, warranties, disclaimers, things of that type. And I view the language of those prior cases as clearly being broad enough for this court to say what those cases mean is not that we're applying them because we really believe every commercial transaction has precisely equal bargaining power between the two parties. That's why I say it's a myth. It isn't true. And not because we believe that in every commercial transaction, the buyer could have said to the seller, by the way, I don't like that warranty. Would you change paragraph 3 and change paragraph 5? Because that's not true either. And I'm sure all of you knew that when that decision was made. What this court is really saying, as explained in Danen and Jansen, I think, is we recognize the fact that purchasers have alternatives in commercial situations. They can choose, they can make intelligent decisions about what risk to accept, what risk not to accept, and how to sell off that risk to commercial insurance carriers if they wish. And that rationale applies perfectly well to Mr. Regner and to State Farm, and it is a perfectly reasonable, valid justification for saying, like most courts have, there's no reason to have a different rule for consumers than you have for commercial entities.
Mr. Johnson, at the start of your remarks, you stated, and this had an appeal to it, and it took me a while to think it through, so I haven't asked it yet until now. You stated that if the purchaser can recover in tort for negligence, then you would advise Ford Manufacturing Company or any manufacturing client to get rid of their warranties.
As they now exist, yes.
As they now exist. Why is that?
Because there would be no point in having any limited warranty.
Well, a warranty would simply be offering a consumer an alternative means of allocating risk, would it not?
But, so what I would tell them to do is provide a warranty which is as broad as the tort law is. There's no limits, which is no warranty at all. A warranty is a limited promise, a limited representation about the quality of the product and how it will perform. Tort law says we have a much broader standard. So what I would tell them to do is eliminate all the limitation language in your warranties, charge whatever you want, or get rid of them altogether, and charge a lot more for the cars, because you're exposed now to liability of a type that is completely inconsistent with warranties. When you buy a tire,
well,
that means you can't...
Maybe we should leave that to the market, and let market forces determine whether that's true or not. Let Ford decide whether they want to offer one in the face of Chevrolet deciding that they don't.
That's an ideal solution. That's the one we have today. That's the one we would have under the economic loss doctrine. The market would decide what consumers wanted in general, what manufacturers would try to find that would be most attractive to consumers, and there may be people out there. For all I know, there may be now. I'm no expert in automotive warranties who say, bumper to bumper, I remember seeing ads, bumper to bumper, 75,000 miles. If you want to spend an extra $5,000 for your car, there's probably somebody out there who say, bumper to bumper forever. Personally, I wouldn't buy it, but there may be people who decide that's the way they want to allocate their risk. They won't buy the comprehensive insurance policy coverage. Perhaps they'll buy it with a big deductible. Instead, they'll spend $5,000 more for the bumper to bumper for the rest of your life, the Midas muffler equivalent of new cars.
Bronco, this is a 1990 Bronco. I had a Bronco. That was a popular car. Let's say we have a quarter of a million, 250,000 1990 Broncos out there. And let's say the 1990 Bronco, as apparently here, is subject to a recall because they spontaneously have fires starting them. Let's say that. And let's say most of these 1990 Broncos are probably at some time or another sold as used cars. The buyers go on and buy a new car, and it's not wrecked, it's not junked, it's sold. If we follow your argument, that means that for these 250,000 1990 Broncos that are defective and the possibility of starting fires, someone else should be that responsibility should not be Ford's, but should be allocated to someone else, either the 20-year-old who has or doesn't have insurance, or State Farm, or an extended warranty purchased through Lloyd's of London. Someone else should take that responsibility if we follow your argument. Am I correct?
Almost, yes. Some way or another, yes. If the contract law, if the contract provisions that govern that vehicle say at some point in time there's no longer any coverage for that, and if I don't pretend to be an expert on federal recall law, which came up earlier, and if there is no federal law that says because of this recall you have to fix it and you're responsible if you don't.
Isn't that kind of a windfall for an automotive industry that makes a dangerous and defective product?
No more than a windfall for the automotive insurance industry that agreed to insure for those kinds of risks, knows when they sell those policies that every vehicle on the road is covered by a less than unlimited warranty, charge the premium for it, and now wants to recover back from the manufacturer.
Well, I followed that the last time you said it, and it occurred to me, too, that, I mean, after all, this is what State Farm is supposed to be insuring against, a car that catches on fire. That's used to pay a special premium for that. But State Farm has a subrogation clause. And the subrogation clause says that they can take over any of their insurance claims against third parties. So if somebody else banged into Mr. Fenberg's car, State Farm would pay Mr. Fenberg, but then State Farm would go out after the other guy who caused the injury, and you're the other guy. I mean, that's what they're saying on Ford. So, I mean, the theory here is that State Farm is, it's a theory, State Farm has set its rates, premium rates, on the basis of how much subrogation it can get. So that's why the argument that, you know, State Farm is just ditching its risk on you doesn't quite ring true.
Except we have both, Ford and State Farm, have made their decisions about what we charge for the car, what we include in the price of this Bronco for risk of having to repair it or replace it later. And they have made their decisions based upon the premiums, taking into account existing warranty law, among other things. And what we're talking about here is whether there should be some principle, which I suggest to you, changes the reasonable expectation of the parties as the risk they're taking. We gave a warranty of one type. The majority of the courts in this country say we're entitled to enforce that warranty and live up to that and no more. State Farm is, if anyone's familiar with the legal environment in which these risks are assessed, commercial carriers like State Farm are, and what is now being sought is an effort to switch that risk. If you do switch that risk, all you're doing is changing who's charging for it. Right. Either we will charge for it in the long run because we are taking on warranty-like expenses that we have not charged for thus far, or I suggest their premiums won't go up or down either way, but I tend to be somewhat cynical about those things, or they will adjust their premiums in some way because they now know those subrogation rights are ever so slightly more valuable.
Let's deal with the law of subrogation. Now, this isn't just an insurance company. This is a subrogated party, which means they stand in the shoes of the injured party. Under the law, they aren't to be treated any differently. And that's why we have the phrase, stand in the shoes of. We can't take into consideration that they're a deep pocket. They are a subrogated party, which is a distinct, a nuance of insurance law. Subrogated party. So you're telling us we should treat them differently because there's a deep pocket. And the law says they stand in the shoes of them. You look at them just as though it were Mr. and Mrs. Smith bringing this lawsuit.
I agree, but I disagree. I agree that they stand in the shoes of Mr. Renberg and that they have his rights, including his limited warranty rights. I disagree that that's an irrelevant consideration because the way in which State Farm's deep pockets have come up have been by questions which suggest that because we've got deep pockets, we should incur that risk. And all I'm suggesting here is if that's the issue, we've got two parties with deep pockets and all you're talking about is whose pocket you're going to reach into. But I agree, they're entitled to have exactly the same treatment Mr. Renberg was entitled to get. Your decisions say whether he bought insurance is relevant to the question of the reasonableness of the application of the economic loss doctrine.
Justice Babbage has a question, counsel.
A number of your arguments, particularly in the last few moments, strike me as being arguments that Judge Posner would make. A law and economics theory that essentially no matter whatever we do, the market is going to adjust for it. Have you considered making that argument, or have you not labeled it as such but have thought about it?
I don't think that's the justification for the decision the court should make because I think the policies the court's enunciated are perfectly adequate. However, the questions have suggested exactly that, and I'm not suggesting that that should be the basis for the court's decision. If you apply the Danson and Jansen decisions, the policy is exactly the same way, I believe you will come to the conclusion that that rule should be applied to this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Coffey?
Let me just touch on a couple of points. The first one is Mr. Johnson came up and said that we want to carve out an exception to the economic loss doctrine. What Mr. Johnson wants to do is carve out an exception to subrogation. Subrogation specifically says that we stand in the shoes of them, that we should be able to go after them. The Pioneer Court said that subrogation is an equitable doctrine, highly favored, that should be given liberal application to it. The idea here is that State Farm didn't do anything wrong. Ford Motor Company essentially admitted in its recall notice that it did do something wrong. And so what Mr. Johnson wants us to do is make an exception for subrogation, not for economic loss. He went on to say that there was no rational basis to exclude consumers from the economic loss doctrine. There is a rational basis. The rational basis is the basis of tort law, which is to protect society as a whole. This man, Mr. Renberg, and the courts have repeatedly said in tort law, we need to protect individuals. We need to protect them because they don't have equal bargaining power, because they can't allocate that risk. And that is the reason, that's the rational basis for accepting this.
Okay, but counsel, if we do that, it strikes me that a very plausible argument can be made, and eventually the consumer pays anyway, sort of the you can pay me now or pay me later kind of thing. If we say that Ford Motor Company is going to have to bear this risk, all they're going to do is increase the price of their product or the manufacturer of the refrigerator. Isn't that right?
I don't think that is right, because if I had a $2,000 laptop sitting in that truck at the time and it got burned up, I'd have other property, and they'd have to pay for it. If I was in that car and I got minor blisters on my fingers, which is a personal injury, they'd have to pay for it. So they're not going to increase the price of the product because there was no other damage done to it, when they know if there's other damage to other property or personal injury, they will have to pay for it.
I've wondered here what the additional property is that you're fighting so hard for to get coverage on, or to get Ford responsible for. You mentioned a laptop.
In this case, there is no other property. My response to...
Any other damages?
No, there are not. I certainly looked for them. There is no other property in this vehicle.
But also, if there were, you would have been successful. You wouldn't have been barred by the economic loss.
Absolutely.
Okay, sorry.
Counsel, the point that I'm making is that if we are to make the manufacturers of a product, essentially the insurers of that product, beyond what they are willing to give us now in terms of a warranty, eventually that's going to be reflected in the cost of the product, is it not?
Again, I don't think that it is, because if there is a minor change in the facts, they are still responsible. So if they were worried about